Abolitionist for Everybody is a podcast that tackles the sometimes difficult conversations around prison abolition. I'm Crystal.
And I'm Graham. This season is about the media's involvement in carceral or abolitionist thinking.
How it uses narratives to impact, radicalize, and shift culture.
Just for a reminder, friends, though the title of this episode may give you some warning, remember that harm itself tends to create situations of alternate harms.
There will likely be other painful topics brought up too. Take care of you. Hi everyone, welcome to episode 9 of Abolitionists for Everybody, our last episode of season 3. In season 3, we talked about the media and its impact on our communities with the way they portray our realities. We know that everything we talked about was hard to listen to, and at times might have been a little bit discouraging. So before ending the season, we wanted to talk about work that folks like us are doing in our daily lives to change the narrative on things like houselessness, incarceration, immigration, and drugs, just to name a few. So to do that, we're joined by Rashida, a very special and good friend of ours. Rashida, can you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
Hello, listeners. My name is Rashida Jones. I am from Los Angeles, California, South Central to be exact. And first, I just want to say thank you for having me. It is an honor to be here with you all. You all are my Initiate Justice family. And again, just super excited to share this platform and space with you all. I work as a mental health advocate in my everyday life, servicing Black and Brown communities in the school system. I'm also an author of a book titled Justice. And then I also do community work as a community organizer, making sure we break isolation with incarceration and encourage people to have a voice in the things that matter to them.
We're so excited to have you. Rashida was actually one of the first people that I met on this new journey after my brother was incarcerated. So we had a lot of healing and bonding moments and, you know, sharing the trauma that our brothers are incarcerated. So I'm so excited that you're here. I know that you do a lot of very important, meaningful, and impactful work. So to begin, I want to learn a little bit more about your book, Justice. I love that you created that. So can you tell us a little bit more about that and why you felt it was important to create that?
Thank you, Crystal. So I created a book titled Justice, and I am a self-published author, meaning I put all of the work into promoting it and getting it out there. And so this book is just a personal story of mine. I wrote it from the perspective of my niece and nephew whose father is incarcerated, which is my brother. And as I wrote the book and finished it, I realized that I was also speaking to the inner child in me as my dad was also incarcerated. And so it was a way to empower my niece and nephew, give them a tangible tool. At the time, we were talking about entrepreneurship, and I just wanted something that they can identify with. But and then as the project became like a tangible tool, I realized that a lot of the students that I was serving could relate to it. And then I realized that the community I was in, which is the Initiate Justice community, SE Justice community, a lot of people can benefit from the story. And so that's really what the story is about, a young boy whose dad is incarcerated. He's having a lot of feelings of embarrassment, a lot of feelings of shame and isolation because of the stigma that's surrounded by incarceration. No one really wants to talk about what those effects are. And so not to tell too much of the story, he starts off feeling all of these negative feelings, but and then it turns into an empowering story where he's able to share his story. And you have a group of community, which are other students who also share similar experiences. And so that's the idea, sharing your story, but being held in community when you share it, and also having tangible tools and coping skills to navigate through those traumatic experiences. Because like you mentioned, dealing with incarceration is a traumatic experience, no matter race, age, sex, gender, whatever, it's traumatic.
I really relate. I'm going to have to get this book. I haven't read it, but I'd like to get a copy of it because my father was also incarcerated when I was growing up. And I remember that that feeling. It was the 90s. And, you know, it was a lot less talked about than it is today. And like growing up, it was always like that secret that you didn't tell people because you didn't want to feel judged, stigmatized. So I really relate to that. I'm excited to read this.
And I think it's beneficial, again, because I wrote it from the inner child. I've had a lot of great feedback in terms of adults saying that it was very adult friendly, and it spoke to the inner child in them.
I love that you created this, because I was very young when my brother was incarcerated the first time, and my nephew's very young, and my brother has a daughter, and they're very little when their own fathers were incarcerated, my nephew's fathers as well, who are not my brother's sons. I experienced that same need, like, to hide that my brother was incarcerated and didn't really like talking about it. And every time anybody would talk about it, I would cry. So one of the things that I've been following in your journey and writing this book is the amount of kids you have met and like signed the book for and taken pictures with them. So I'm curious to know what that's been like, because you're shifting the narrative and lifetime and looking at these young boys and girls going through things that we've been through that, like Ram said, we didn't even talk about. So I'm curious to see what that experience has been like, because the work that you're doing now and shifting the narrative with these kids is going to go with them through like future generations.
There's so many perspectives I look at with this project, because one, as someone in a school system, I'm looking at it in terms of education, like the importance of literacy in our communities. A lot of our students are getting away from books. They're on the iPads. And reading is not, at least in the community that I serve, as affluent. And so from an educator standpoint, I'm like, let me create something where kids can read and enjoy reading. And so the book is colorful. And the feed that I've been receiving from that part is it's an easy read for our students. And it's relatable in terms of what the kids are wearing in there in representation as to the characters looking like them, from their hair to the images on the wall. So I enjoy that feedback as an educator, that they're enjoying the literacy part of it. From the mental health standpoint of it, that therapist in me is like, thank you so much for expressing how you feel, and allowing me to hold space for you and trusting me to tell me, like, you know, Ms. Jones, like, my dad is in jail and I felt how the boy felt. And it makes me sad because, again, it's like a trigger because I was once that kid. But then it also makes me like I'm honored to hold space for them. It's truly an honor for these kids to trust me. And so that's one way that I perceive it. And then again, this is the joy. Like, again, representation matters. Like, I'm a Black woman from L.A. I'm young, and we don't see that too often. At least I didn't see it growing up. So for them to be able to say, like, hey, I know an author, like, you wrote a book, to show like that it's actually attainable. And I did it by myself with no handouts, no big budget. It was just like a leap of faith for me and following a dream. So there's so many different avenues in which I look at it, but ultimately the feeling is like, I'm very proud of the work and I'm proud of the conversation that it's creating. And I'm proud that, again, not only do they read it, again, tangible tools are very important. And so it has questions like, well, how does incarceration make you feel? That's important. Like, we don't ask those questions. And now that you feel that way, what can you do to feel better? What are some helpful things? So it's just, again, you read it, you create dialogue, but then it also is a tool that navigates further discussion as to how you can navigate through the experience. So I know that was a lot. But again, I view it in so many different ways. And each day I meet a kid, it always provides me something different, because everybody has different perspectives and how they interpret the book. So it's constantly a joy when I hear the excitement from a student. The other day, a student came in my office and was like, I seen your book in the store. And then once he said it, I ran to my car and I grabbed a bookmark and I gave it to him. He was like, I can't wait to read this to my sister. And that was a beautiful moment, because again, my kids don't like to read at school. Like, they hate English class, they hate writing. And I think it's not that they hate it, but there's challenges within that. So for them to be able to relate in terms of their personal experience and then at school, again, it's a really good feeling.
Now, you and I have known each other for like, what, 3.5 years now. We went through Institute together.
Together.
And we constantly run into each other in various meetings and little spaces. So I'm curious to know how your community work is going outside of the book and what you've been engaged in recently.
So it's been a while since I've been in space, and that's because the reality is that life is happening for a lot of people, and especially me. The book success has been good, but There was a time in my community organizing work where I didn't say no, and I wanted to be everywhere doing everything, and it was stretching me really thin. And I realized, especially in the healing space, is there was so much more healing work that I needed. And so I had taken a step back. I'm still very active in one of my organizations, ESSE, in terms of breaking isolation. But I want to get back into the policy work, because I do know, like, when you understand policy and implement policy and you go up there and you lobby on those bills that we talk about, that's where I'm not going to say the real work happens, but that work is just as important. So all of the components are important, but I enjoyed that part of it because that's the part that I always shied away from. So right now I'm still active in ESSE, again, breaking isolation one woman at a time, making sure that their stories are heard, making sure that they felt seen, making sure that they understand that the system, and when we talk about the incarceration system, that our loved ones are not inmates, our loved ones are not CDC numbers, and really empowering the women. And we do that through a 9-week cohort. So I'm still involved in the community. It's just me understanding that I can't be everywhere at all times while still working my 9-to-5, while still trying to pursue my dreams as an author.
Yeah, I totally get that. I went through the same thing. I think it was kind of taught. It was like instructed into us to just say yes, because there's so much to do. And if you volunteer for everything,
you won't have there is no time for self.
Yeah. But it was easy, Grandma, when we did it. It was easy, though, that we were able to do it because we had the autonomy of being virtual. So it was easy to hop off one thing and go to the next and go to the next. But now that we're coming back into real spaces, it's like, is that really realistic for me to be and to be, you know, downtown LA in 30 minutes? It's just not.
I want to uplift and highlight that goes back to us so working so tirelessly to change the narrative and show that not everything that is being shared on social media or by the police or by CDC or the carceral system is an accurate representation of what us and our loved ones are going through and what it means to be impacted by incarceration. Because I do the same thing, like wanting to sign up for everything and wanting to help with everything. Because I recognize the amount of work that needs to be done. I think one of the things that continues to shock me, don't know why, but it continues to shock me, it's just the intentionality of the prison system, the prison industrial complex, and the media being one of them. So that's another thing I've added to my list of things I want to accomplish as an abolitionist, contradicting what the media is teaching us. And Graham, I know you do a lot of that work too, so I'd love for you to share with the listeners the type of work that you do to do that as well.
Sure. My day job, my 9-to-5, is Success Stories Program. And it started at the same time as IJ, actually, in the same prison, in the same visiting room. And the concept behind it is if I'm going to summarize, it's like, let's discuss the beliefs that we have, beliefs being like the founding force of harm and oppression, right? Let's discuss the beliefs that we have that are harming others, challenge those beliefs, and dismantle them. So that sounds very general, but in a very specific sense, we discuss patriarchy and we discuss the effect of patriarchy. Patriarchy being both a culture and a belief system that circumvents growth and halts progress and also harms many, many people, primarily people of color and women. So it oppresses people of color and women, and it suppresses men and their ability to express emotion and relate to others in an effective way that isn't based on dominance. So it's a lot to say. Like, I work primarily in prisons. My work goes into right now 10 prisons, 4 high schools, 1 middle school, a youth center, and we're working to get into spaces in other states and other countries. And it's really, really beneficial work. I'm thinking about what you said about the intentionality of the prison system. So I just entered Wasco State Prison this week and last week. So we've been contracted with Wasco for multiple years. Clearance has been the issue. They've not been willing to clear us. Finally, they clear me. I go up. There's an incident, so we don't get to have it. I go up this week, and the person who I'm working with says, oh, well, we didn't give them ducats. Ducats are like a piece of paper that their name is on. It goes to the person in their cell so that they know to be somewhere at a certain time. So this sounds like a harmless mistake. Oh, we don't give them ducats because it's a voluntary group. We don't need to. It seems like an act of consideration that didn't happen, right? But that's not what it is. It's bred into the system. Do not care. So this is what really takes place. A list is put up in the wing where people live. They volunteer for a group, not told the day, not told the time, 3 months before. 3 months before the actual group is actually established and people come in. So with the prison, with the system, the administration is thinking is they signed up, they should know, listen to the speaker. What the people in the cell are like is I put my name on a paper hoping that I'll get into a group. That almost never happens. So they had no idea that they were going to be there. And the intentionality is they don't want people in groups. They don't want people to come home. They don't want people earning time off their sentences. That little act, lack of consideration on the administration's part for the individual that works in the administration is like, oh, well, they should be on their game, right? But for, you know, on a human perspective, really, it was intentional. It was an effort to keep people out of group by not letting them know that they need to be in a specific place at a specific time to get marked for attendance to get time off your sentence. So I told the administration that. I told them you need to give them ducats because it makes no sense to think that 90 days after they put their name on a paper in the day room, that they're going to know, oh, I need to be in education at 1 o'clock on Monday on April 6th. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
I like how you're like, and I told them that I know that that's what they're doing. So one question that has come up for me, one thing that I think about a lot when I do this work is the times that I'm feeling kind of tired and burned out and losing, you know, that little bit of hope. Like there's times that I have to wake up and just be like, come on, Crystal, you got this. Like there's a lot of work to do. And I'm wondering what it's like with you all, like all of the barriers that you face, Graham, going inside the prisons. Like I can't imagine dealing with CDCR like on a daily, weekly basis. And you, Rashida, you know, I've followed your journey and I've seen everything that you go through. We all go through as system impacted people. So curious to know what keeps y'all going? What makes it worth it?
I'm always rooted in my why, like why I'm doing what I'm doing. And so my why has always been like service to others, service to people, empowering myself, empowering my community. But then ultimately, like my goal in this work is to free my brother, who's been wrongly incarcerated for the last 26 years. But when I say free him, I know that freeing him is freeing so many other of our loved ones. He's in jail with a life without the possibility of parole sentence. I know once his situation is overturned, everybody else has another chance at life. And so I keep that at the forefront. That is so much bigger than me. But one thing that I have changed is when I'm tired, I remind myself to rest. I am no good to this work if I'm burnt out and I'm tired and I'm weary. There's enough people in the community to spread the work. And so for me in this work, healing was my passion. And so I went straight to the healing committee and found purpose there and allowed and created space for people there. A mentor of mine, she said, find your place in the struggle, find your place in the front line. It doesn't necessarily always have to be in the front. Maybe you'll be in the back. Maybe you'll be cooking the meal. Maybe you'll be wiping the tears of someone, but wherever it is, again, you can do all of it, but then what will you have for yourself? And so I'm reminded of that. I'm reminded of my brother, and I'm always hopeful. I may be tired, but then I'm very hopeful that he will be set free. I'm very hopeful that this system will end. I'm very hopeful that I'll see it in this lifetime. But if I don't, that the work that all that we're doing and the generations after us will continue in this movement to end it. And so even being in spaces like this, Crystal, hearing your story, Graham, meeting you when you were fresh out and hearing your story, like those are things that are inspiring me to continue the work. I was inspired that she would come all the way from Orange County, Graham, to downtown LA for us to sit in these 3-hour meetings, you know, to learn the work and then to see where we are now. And the same for you, Crystal, like seeing you come in and like look at where you are. You brought your sister along and now you guys are trailblazing in the work. And so those are moments that keep me going.
I like that. And I think my response would be the same, the why. When I met you, I was fresh out. I was 2.5 months out and I was like terrified to jaywalk. And there was all sorts of things I hadn't done and that I didn't know if I was going to do or not. And I was working in a moving company, just starting with Success Stories. And then you fast forward 4 years. And I don't know if y'all relate because I know both of you personally and within workspaces. Like, we dug in, we jumped in and said yes to everything, like we were talking about earlier. And then you see the amount of work that there is, and it's overwhelming. It relates a lot to the sensation that some of the listeners may have had from listening to season three, because a lot of the problems seem way bigger than what one person or 10 people or 10,000 people could do. And that connects directly with general burnout from doing too much and not taking care of yourself. And you sit back and one day you wake up and you go, man, I have too much to do. And you don't feel the joy that comes from the work that we get to do in that moment. Maybe it comes back later in the day. I don't know. But I think, like, personally, that's my experience. And a way that I tend to that is I give myself leave to take care of myself more often today. I've experienced a significant amount of ups and downs, I guess. I don't want to say more or less than anyone else, but a significant amount of ups, significant amount of downs in recent months. And if I don't take care of myself, then molehills turn into mountains and everything seems impossible and I don't feel joy from my work. And I'm just driving 3 hours to a prison, miserable the whole time back, in there completing whatever's in my curriculum from point A to point Z. And it becomes work. And I think the work is different than actual work. So I found that, like, realizing that this is the work, like, this is life work. This isn't about a paycheck. It's not about making it from 9 to 5, even though we referenced that earlier in the meeting. It is the work, like, and staying clear on the why that needs to happen is super important to me. That's my experience. It's super important to me so that I can keep the hope alive, because otherwise the amount of obstacles that you hit feel insurmountable.
I love the aha moments when I do the work. So, like you were talking about, Rashida, when you meet the children and even like the adults that realize that they're not alone, or that realize that something can be done about this. Those, and like when people come home, I love those moments, but also the moments of realization that people have. I was a co-host on season 2 and I've had people come up to me and tell me that they've learned so much from the podcast. Or last year in 2022, we had an art gallery that featured 11 artists, incarcerated artists from the state of California. And I had a lot of people tell me that they didn't realize that somebody can get 6 life sentences, or that somebody can have life without the possibility of parole, like your brother does, Rashida. And I've had people in the past tell me, oh, like your brother's incarcerated, but your family is so nice. And I didn't realize until later that it's like the narrative that the media is showing them, and just everything that they're consuming everywhere. So for me, it is the freedom days of folks who've been incarcerated, and the moments of realization in my community that something better, and we can build something better and something more empathetic and something more loving that takes care of one another. So I think those are the moments that have been important for me, and part of the reason why I love this podcast so much. We created this podcast because we realized that in order to accomplish abolition, we have to shift the narrative that people have on people who are incarcerated. We have to tell the stories of people who are directly impacted, and what could have helped us, and what could help us in this work as well, like to free our brothers, sisters, moms. So yeah, the podcast was born because we know that that's something that needs to happen.
I would like to add, as I was listening to you both, it takes me back to my recent experience. I just completed the Los Angeles Marathon, where we ran from the Dodger Stadium to Century City, right? And initially when I was asked, why was I doing it? I was like, because I just want to prove that I can. And I want it to make me mentally strong, physically strong. And it was something that I could do for myself. Like, I feel like I'm always doing something for the purpose of others, which is good. But I was like, I'm owning this experience. And this is for Rashida. But then as I'm training and as I'm preparing for it, it hit me that my brother has been incarcerated for 26 years. And then as I'm running, I'm realizing like the amount of liberty and freedom that I have just being able to use my body and go across Los Angeles on foot. And then it kind of made me sad that my brother was not able to experience this. And so like the meaning behind me running got deeper and deeper. And so I changed it. I was like, I'm running on behalf of him. And then I'm running on behalf of all of those men are, or men and women who are behind bars in prison who don't have the opportunity to do so. Like I think they said you have to run around the yard maybe 90 something times to equal 26 miles. Like that's a lot. But as I'm doing it, I was like, yeah, I'm dedicating this and I'm running for justice. So now people are like, well, justice of what? Now you have people curious. And so I'm like, well, justice of my brother. And now I'm telling his story. And then it allows me the opportunity to talk about like how incarceration has an impact on people and how this has become a coping skill. And so something that turned into a personal goal for me, again, still tied back to like something bigger than me. And so I was able to run each mile in honor of him. And then more people were able to hear his story. And now, you know, people are looking up like, well, what can I do to help? And that's the work. So even though I'm not literally sitting in a community center and talking and, you know, it's conversation, we're changing the narrative. A small conversation about, you know, justice and what you can do and how you can take a political stand in something, that changes something. And so I just wanted to share that story, how something so personal became something so big and monumental for me on behalf of my family and community. And then, again, I'm able to promote mental health in the process, physical health in the process. Those are moments where, again, it becomes bigger than us because we need those things to survive and to keep the balance in this work.
I love that. Thank you so much for sharing that, Rashida. So what would you all tell people who aren't impacted by incarceration? What should they be on the lookout for? What should they pay attention to?
I would say to listen to the voices of those who are impacted, like pay attention to our stories and what we have to say, and to those who are formerly incarcerated and to those who are currently incarcerated, go read Justice and share that with the little ones in your life and the adults in your life, and share the story that Rashida just told about the marathon and how impactful that was. And I mentioned the gallery earlier. Go read the stories of the incarcerated artists and why they decided to tell the story that they're telling you. And once you start listening to those that are directly impacted, you'll be able to understand what it is that's happening and what it is that us abolitionists are trying to build for our communities.
I would say to the people to remain informed and aware whether you're impacted or not, and then use your power for something, again, that's bigger than you. Everybody possesses power, but what you choose to do with that power makes all of the difference. So if you want to be more involved, get involved. And then once you're involved, again, do the work.
Yeah. And if somebody wants to use their power to support you, what can they do? Please tell us more about how somebody can support you, follow you in your journey.
Yes, absolutely. First, I just want to thank you all again for allowing me to have this space and share this space with you all. It's been a minute, so I am glad to be here again. You can follow me at Tafiq's Publishing, and that is on Instagram. The book is titled Justice, so you type it in Google. You can find it on Amazon, on bookbaby.com. If you're interested in me coming to a school organization to read more about it, there is a curriculum that I have with the book. So once I read it, there's an activity book and just sharing space. So again, if you're interested, that is my contact information. Tafiq's Publishing@gmail, tafiqspublishing.com, Tafiq's Publishing at Instagram.
Thank you so much for joining us, Rashida. Thank you, Crystal, for an amazing season. This is the end of season 3. And remember to ask questions. Ask questions. Ask questions about what's going on around you. Ask questions about what's happening, things that you feel are unjust. Ask continual questions. I think that the narrative reinforces a silence for folks who are previously incarcerated or incarceration impacted. And it's very important that you ask questions and speak up. That's how we find our power and re-identify our power. And that's how we build power.
You've been listening to Abolitionist for Everybody. Be sure to follow us at abolitionist_ on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook for regular updates.
If you want to continue to support this podcast and our work overall, you can donate to support Initiate Justice at initiatejustice.org/donate.